This is an RNZ podcast.
No mai whakarongo mai ki te Aotai Whanua. Thanks for joining us on Country Life. I'm Sally Round.
And I'm Duncan Smith. G'day. Today, we're off fishing. We're casting off with 9-year-old Isla, who's in her waders at a pond teeming with trout near the Tongariro River.
Cosmo meets some farmers near Lake Ellesmere, taking things into their own hands to clean up waterways flowing through their land.
And we find out how the truffle season's going. Seems like the wet weather has really taken a toll.
But first, let's take a tour of the country to find out how farms and orchards have been faring this very wet week.
In Northland, ground conditions are boggy, but grass is still growing. The backlog to get culled stock into the meatworks is currently less than a week. Farmers are being encouraged to get stock to the works now in case there are future delays due to COVID-related staff shortages. Coomera growers are having a frustrating time. Sales are about 20% down compared with last year, and growers say prices being offered by supermarkets are the lowest for at least a decade. In South Auckland, rainfall eased back this week, but 26 millimetres still fell. With a fine day once a week, most growers are managing to get onto their fields to plant, fertilise and spray their crops, even if the timing is a bit late.
Share milkers in Waikato are flat out with calving and milking, as well as moving stock to avoid muddy pastures. Staff shortages are seeing pay rates increase, and workers aren't necessarily coming from a rural background. There are more tradies, such as builders and electricians, moving with their families from bigger towns and cities to take up farming work. Bay of Plenty's had about 730 millimetres of rain since the end of May, and conditions are being described as rather trying, the total opposite from earlier in the year when many were desperate for moisture. At least it's mild, and grass is inching along. On sheep farms, there are quite a few dry ewes, meaning they're not pregnant, due to feed conditions back at mating time. Scanning showed about 15% of ewes were dry.
A King Country farmer says he hasn't seen such good pasture growth at this time of year ever, and he's been farming for 40 years. The combination of good moisture and soil temperatures means grass is jumping out of the ground. Soil temperatures of 12 degrees are being recorded when normally it's 5 to 8 degrees. And Taupo's porous pumice soil has enjoyed the steady patter of rain with warmer temperatures, so its pastures are also doing well. Calving is underway in mild wet conditions in Taranaki, up to 100 millimetres fell in some parts. Pay rates have jumped up here as well, with farmers needing to fill farm roles. There's also a new sheep milking venture gaining traction in the region.
It's been wet in Hawke's Bay, but not as bad as many other regions. Subsoil water levels are well nourished after 4 wet months. Decent frosts have pleased orchardists as trees like winter chill. Pip and stone fruit trees are being pruned, and apple growers are looking at pulling out old blocks or grafting new varieties onto trees, as export prices have been squeezed this year. The mood of orchardists is described as pretty reserved. Manawatu farmers are clearing tracks covered with sodden slips. It's the wettest winter for at least 4 years. Calving started and cows are being moved around to avoid muddy areas. It's been a sunny end to the week in Wairarapa after a stormy start, which felled trees and caused slips. Ewe scanning's finished for most, and farmers are optimistic that decent lamb prices will continue.
Across the Cook Strait in Nelson, the conditions are being described as pretty bloody wet, cold and windy. Wind straight off the mountains. And this weekend, there is a rural community gathering being put on at the Tupperwera Rugby Club. Down the east coast in Ward, seas have been rough, so fishers after crayfish haven't been out much. The rain also saw a lobster processing factory flood, halting work there. Luckily, crays are still being caught in Marlborough Sounds. Lobster prices in China have dropped due to shipping costs and COVID. On the west coast, grass is growing and there's a spring feel in the air. However, farmers are feeding out plenty of baleage, palm kernel and grain. The coast has been struck with plenty of winter flu alongside COVID, so finding enough workers has been difficult. The local farmers are getting a free box of butter from Westland Milk as it has just opened an upgraded butter factory in Hokitika.
Canterbury's had some pretty punishing nor'west winds at the start of the week, damaging trees, pivot irrigators and power supply. This was followed up with heavy rain, which caused some localised flooding. It had been nice to get a week of fine, frosty weather. Cows and in-calf heifers are heading back to dairy platforms for calving and the start of another milking season. In South Canterbury, farmers say there haven't been significant issues with flooding, but there hasn't been any reprieve, with three major bouts of rain in as many weeks, totalling at least 140 millimetres. Between wet days, shearing is underway, and a farmer contact said his cattle were as happy as Larry, thanks to ample grass. In North Otago, forestry is becoming increasingly popular, and while some farmers are disappointed, others are joining in and planting trees. However, an increasing number of wallabies are dining on saplings, crops and pasture.
Inland to the Hydro Lakes areas, and water levels have been waist high near Twisel with this week's storm. A beef and sheep farmer says a combination of rain and melting snow has resulted in the highest levels of surface water he has ever seen on his farm. Simon Williamson says there was plenty of warning and he had moved his sheep and cattle to higher ground.
It's made a mess where it's run through paddocks, and it makes a mess when you're out there with tractors and bits and pieces trying to get the stock. We'll just wait and see what next week brings, I guess. The water's retreating, but it's still quite high. I've got a creek beside my house that normally you could walk through and it would come halfway up to your knees. It's about 2 metres, 3 metres wide. And at the moment, there's bank to bank, there's about 20 metres of water and it would be up to your chest. It's still flowing round through my front lawn, through the garden.
Simon Williamson says it's now time to mend the fences and thankfully there's plenty of lucerne and fodder beet to feed out. Elsewhere in high altitudes, helicopters have dropped lucerne hay to cattle in snow, and farmers have also been dropped via helicopter to use shovels and stamp their feet to make paths for ewes to follow down.
And in Southland, ewe scanning's in full swing and fertility rates are down about 10% compared with last year. It's been wet, but plenty of winter chores like fencing are underway. Talk around the paddocks is about the Three Waters and worries about foot and mouth disease, which is in Indonesia. And on that note, farmers everywhere are being advised to make sure they send stock to the meatworks when they're ready, as opposed to hanging on to them for that much longer.
Country Life. For a quarter of a century, we've been bringing you the sounds and voices of rural New Zealand.
The demand for a special and elusive fungus is sky high, but wet weather is taking its toll. Truffles are sometimes described as smelling like a well-worn pair of socks, and despite that, they are a much sought-after delicacy. A spokesperson for the Truffle Association, Maureen Binns, grows them in Paengaroa, and she's coming towards the end of her truffle harvest. She says they're only harvesting about a third of what they would normally.
This season has been really a tough one because our truffles have need firstly snorkels and then later on scuba gear. It's been appallingly wet when I would just like the rain to stop and go away. Caused a lot of rot. It's been quite disheartening at times because here we'd be going through digging up 10 truffles and only two of them would still be really, really good truffles. The other ones will have ripened and rotted.
Despite this, is there an increased demand, do you think, for them within New Zealand?
Oh, yes, yes. The waiting list for our truffle hunts, for example, is just amazingly long. We've put on extra truffle hunts, and every time someone gets COVID, there's other people, you know, filling in those spaces. The number of people who want to buy truffles just for themselves has increased. I've got a waiting list, you know, for truffles, and I think that's the case everywhere. There's just a real interest that there's something special that we've now got in New Zealand.
And it's been a bit trickier for some to locate the truffles this year.
Well, I tell you what, if you get COVID and you lose your sense of smell, you can't. And I've read that from one of our members. So we have a trained truffle dog that we got as a puppy and very easily trained on little tiny canisters with holes in and pieces of ripe truffle. So the person that we bought our trees from, once we should have been producing and we didn't know if we were, he gave us some ripe truffle, which we cut up, kept in the freezer and hidden little tiny canisters. So we trained our dog, who's now 8 years old, and this is his seventh season here of finding ripe truffles. So we've trained him on the aroma of ripe truffles. But when the truffles start and when they're growing, from November, December through till about April when they stop growing, there is no aroma. The aroma starts appearing and dispersing as the truffles ripen between April and late May, early June here in the Bay of Plenty.
Maureen Binns of the Truffle Association. There are more than 300 truffiers in New Zealand. Maureen says an increasing number of restaurants and keen home cooks are prepared to pay more than $3.50 per gram for the black gold.
You're listening to Country Life on RNZ National, 101 FM.
It's midwinter and the height of the trout spawning season. I've joined families watching rainbow and brown trout perform their procreation ritual in the Waihukahuka stream, south of Turangi, in the centre of the North Island.
There's a scolarfish.
A scolarfish, yeah.
People don't teach those.
The trout look to be resting, but there's actually quite a bit of drama going on. The female, the hen, is looking for the likeliest dad to fertilise her eggs. The males, who are known as jacks, are busy eyeing up their competitors, and sometimes getting into fights using a hook in their jaw. A shallow trench is dug as a nest, the eggs are laid, then fertilised, and then after a swish of the tail to cover and protect them, they're left to hatch. The fingerlings eventually making their way to Lake Taupo via the Tongariro River. We're at the Tongariro National Trout Centre, where you can learn all about trout and native fish, and where children can feed trout for some school holiday fun. They can also learn to fly fish in a specially stocked pond set up for kids, like Isla Peterson.
Are you left-handed or right-handed?
Right.
Okay, put your right hand on. Mm-hmm. So what would like you to
do? My name is Isla. I'm just about to go fishing and I'm wearing waders.
You can see the fish down there?
Yeah.
Okay.
My name's Doug Stevens. I'm on the board of the Trout Centre. I'm a very keen fisherman and I love to take young kids out and show them how the skills and get them to catch a trout for the first time.
So what I would like you to do now is we're going to actually use the rod to cast together. So I'm going to
You pull it backwards and then the line goes into the water.
So do you see that movement?
Yeah.
Here it comes. Now you see there's an orange little bit on the end of the line.
Yep.
That's called the indicator.
When it sinks, it tells you a fish has grabbed your fly and you can grab the fish.
See that little movement there? And you've got yourself a fish. Okay, so now change hands and wind in.
You need to wind it up and when it starts pulling, you should stop. And when the lines, the fluffy thing sinks, you have to yank up
that
the line.
It. Doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Damn.
Oh, we hit him. When you yell yes, I want you to do that. So you give it a jerk up. That's called a strike.
Okay,
keep going. Come.
Yep.
This time you got one. That was a fantastic strike. As soon as that fish took, you struck, which was good.
It is something that kids from the big cities don't get a chance to do, go and actually see some fish, put out a line, learn how to cast or even get the basics of casting and hook a fish, land it, have it cooked for them when smoked and get the photos and the T-shirt and say, look
and
how clever I am.
Okay, lift them in. That's it. Well done. That's a good fish. Now you know what to do next. You're going to actually have to hit it with the dongy knocker. Can't be gentle doing that. We want to kill them quite quickly. Okay, now the next thing is we're going to actually put a bit of flax through the mouth. If we can find a bit of flax.
Some flax over here.
Yep. And what I want you to do is lift them up by the gills.
Yep.
and then spread that through the under the gill, through the mouth. So what we do is we go around like that and see if you can do it. Yep, that's good. Save you having to carry the fish in your hands, get them all fishy.
That was good.
Cool. That was a bigger fish this time.
Well, she got that one. She actually struck on that one herself, which is really good.
Awesome. Hey.
My name is Julia Vary, and I am the kids fishing ambassador here at the Tongariro Trout Fishing Centre in Tūrangi. Here we have a beautiful pond out in front of us where we have our kids fishing program, which runs every school holidays. And out on the pond, we have a group of volunteers who dedicate their time, due to having a huge passion for fly fishing, to teach kids and sometimes their parents or caregivers how to cast on the pond and catch their first fish. I caught my first fish here when I was 5, so 36 years ago is where I caught my first trout, and it's a wonderful experience for a lot of kids. Yeah, to have that experience for the first time. A lot easier, obviously, here on the pond where it's in a controlled environment and much safer to learn here than it is on a river. So a lot of these kids have this first amazing childhood experience with their loved ones. And our goal here is to educate, teach them about fishing, the ecosystem, and hopefully at some stage later in life they might want to take it up themselves. And perhaps a new hobby for the family together to do something.
Why do you think it's important for kids to learn about fishing?
Oh, just getting kids outside. I think as a society we have progressed probably more indoors, specifically after COVID. 2 years of being locked inside, people are frightened even re-emerging back out into society again. People are having a hard time either with, you know, mental health, anxiety, scared of what might happen, unsure of what's happening, you know, from a political side of things. So our big thing here is to try and encourage families and young ones and friends to get back outdoors and connect with their natural environment. I think as humans we need that. We need that connectivity to our outdoors. And in New Zealand, fishing is amazing because people don't realise what's in their backyard and so easily accessible. A lot of these rivers that we drive over every single day have fish in them, and people would have no idea if they stopped, pulled over and went bushwhacking or explored that they might find a beautiful, tranquil spot and have a great, incredible moment and memory, you know, together as a family. It's cool.
You used to be in the police, Julia. How did you get to become a fishing ambassador here?
Yeah, a bit weird, isn't it? So 10 years I had policing, and I guess at the end of my policing career, you see the highs and lows of what people face in society, and I just saw it as a really wonderful opportunity when I was asked to step into the role as a give back to the community, and especially for those families and children that don't get to have special experiences together. So this morning Isla and I were out on the Tongariro River this morning together. That was her first time actually casting into the river. She's starting to graduate from the pond here, which is great. The river this morning was a bit fast paced for her, so we did it we were as careful as we possibly could just after all that rain that we've had come through. But it's really cool having that time to connect in with your kids, and something that she will remember forever, here's hoping. But I certainly do, remembering, you know, those times with my grandfather fishing and my dad. You know, they're just moments that you never forget. It's all about being out there together and interacting with our natural environment. The bird life is incredible, especially this time of year with kereru and tui and the fantails chasing you around. It's just beautiful.
What about the numbers of people fishing nowadays?
Globally, for women specifically, the numbers for fly fishing have increased exponentially, and that's because it's an easily accessible sport, but also as well it's something that a lot of women are getting involved in, because I believe that they are really good at it because they're patient, and it's just evolving bit by bit, and kids as well, we're seeing so many more people out on the river than I've ever seen before.
Is it an expensive sport? Can anyone get involved?
It can be, but once you've got your gear, you've got your gear. It's a lifetime thing. And it doesn't need to be. There's always options, of course, with a lot of things and how we structure it with our kids and with all the sports that we're involved in. We opt for secondhand, so shopping smart. It doesn't need to be new gear, especially when you're starting out. All you need really is a rod, and it doesn't need to be excessively expensive. It can be secondhand, and there are really affordable options as well for beginners.
How accessible are the rivers?
There's a massive variety of different access points. So some are easier than others. Some are more kid appropriate than others. Here in Turangi, there's a whole range of different options in terms of access. This morning, Isla and I went down off a point off Grace Road, which is one local spot, and that's really easy for children. She can just walk straight in, doesn't need to cross a river or do anything like that. It can be really simple, and there's many spots that you don't even need to enter the water.
Shall we go and have a look at some of the streams around here?
Yeah, definitely.
Isla's ready to go.
She is. I feel like that's not a good river crossing stick.
Back to the Tongariro National Trout Centre, where there's a lot being planned, like outdoor classrooms for schools. Here's Doug Stevens again.
We're actually developing a whole education programs for the school. The Ministry of Education has given us a huge amount of support by putting a good sum of money in towards getting a program going. It's going to be based not just around the trout fishing, but around the whole idea of ecology, protecting our waters, and being responsible with nature. So we're really hoping that schools are going to come in. We can do things like testing the quality of the water. We can look at what is natural in the water that we want and what is something that we do not want, and the algae and those sort of things. Now, there's no way we can get around it. Trout have had an enormous impact on our environment. They've had an enormous impact on the native fish, but they're here to stay. They would be almost impossible to actually get rid of all the trout now. And they are part of our culture now. I mean, it does provide a lot of food for a lot of families as well in some of the more remote areas. But it also brings in, believe it or not, between $400 and $500 million a year in overseas earnings from people coming to New Zealand to go fishing.
I guess that was before COVID.
Yeah, it was before COVID, yes. But it's coming back again now. You go down on the river now, and there's a lot from Australia in particular coming back to New Zealand for the fishing. But it's an important part. We are really the trout fishing mecca of the world. There is better trout fishing here than probably anywhere else, anywhere where there are big fish that are in large numbers in virtually every river and lake around the country. And we have to look at the fact that trout are part of our system now, but we've got to actually make sure that we're also protecting the other species that are being challenged by the trout in the water.
Doug's a former teacher himself. He says the centre's really going to be beefing up the education element.
What we would like to be able to do is take kids from very, very early ages, the very young kids who can come down here. They might do just looking at what the fish are in the water and how they are and what they eat and so on, through to actually tertiary level. In fact, we've got a university coming from California in January, and they are going to be looking at the whole ecology and the whole natural environment and how we're going about protecting it. And in that, there's actually a really important aspect to it too. We would like to actually people to know more about how the Maori culture is looked after their environment. So we have a little experience called the Red Chair Experience, where for 2 hours we'll have local iwi will come in and talk about the myths. They'll talk about the way that they looked after the environment, what a rahui is and all of those sort of things. And that is proving to be incredibly popular. In fact, it's actually so popular that the teachers have said, can we just come down and actually have that for ourselves?
Indoors now to find out some big plans for the trout hatchery.
My name is Bevan Severinson. I'm the CEO of the National Trout Centre based here in Turangi. The hatchery here has been in this, well, it was here, I think from the early 1920s, and it was originally built here to provide and to stock the local fishery here with trout. And as were a number of hatcheries that were built around the country in the the early 1900s, and so this facility has been here been nearly 100 years now. And this one here is not used anymore by the department for stocking the taupo fishery, but we use it as an important part of what we do with the kids fishing program, right from the stripping of the hens through to the full-size adult trout that end up in the big raceways out the back, and then those used to be put into the local fishery here. These days, it's just run purely to keep the kids' ponds stocked and gives us the opportunity to provide a lot of, advocacy and opportunity for young children to get a feel of trout fishing, fly fishing.
Explain why there is no need now to have a hatchery and to put stocks into the lake.
The taupo fishery is run and managed by the Department of Conservation, based here in Tirangi, and they manage it on behalf of the Crown and their relationship with Tūwhiri Toa here. The rest of the country, the trout fishery and the rest of the game licensing is run by Fish and Game. So we're quite unique here in this part of the country. And so this hatchery here is no longer needed to support the local fishery as it is fully sustainable. And, at the moment, for example, the last couple of years have been fantastic years for the trout running back up the streams. And, most local anglers have been pretty happy with the stocks of trout and the condition that they are.
Now you have another plan for this hatchery.
Yeah, so towards the end of at the other end of this hatchery, we are working on a plan in cooperation with Aquaponics New Zealand to put in a working aquaponics module. So that's growing fresh food and kai out of fish waste. There's a nice segue between our native fishery and growing kai. It's like, hydroponics on steroids, So we have a company based in the South Island that's going to assist us with putting that in, and it's going to be a working model to show people, the science behind aquaponics and how that works with relationship to fresh water, and so how plants remove some of the nitrates and all of that out of fish waste and grow food. Fresh
and
food.
How much kai will you be able to grow?
Well, here, it's not going to be a huge production, but we're going to look at a number of different species and really just show people what is achievable if they wanted to do it. The big picture is that food's getting a lot more expensive out there. And for some people, access to the fresh vegetables and all of that is getting harder and harder and more expensive. So this is our intention here, is to show people that there's another way.
Hmm. And you're doing this in conjunction with local iwi?
Yes, we've got some of our local people on our team that are helping put this together. We would like to think that this is a project that's done in cooperation with the local hapu here in Tūrangi, and the benefits of what will come out of this will be shared in the community. That's the intention. We're hoping by this time next year that it will be all up and running. So it's a pretty exciting project for us. And we're hoping that that's going to be a nice addition to the freshwater story that we've got here at the Trout Centre.
Bevan Severinsen of the Tongariro National Trout Centre. Check out photos of the kids and their trout on our webpage.
Hi, I'm Clint Meyer from Fire Dragon Chilies in the far north, and you're listening to Country Life on RNZ National.
Back in drier times, Country Life headed to a farm in Canterbury's Selwyn district. Cosmo Kentish Barnes is beside a stream with a couple of farmers who are members of a group helping to keep the waterways and the catchment clean and healthy, despite the intensive farming further upstream. Ellesmere Sustainable Agriculture, or ESAI, is not new. In fact, it's been going for two decades. They've received government money to help fund one of their initiatives, Project Tinuku. First up, Cosmo talks to David Burkett.
We're at the Jolly's Brook here in Ellesmere, and Jolly's Brook is one of the lowland streams, many lowland streams that flow through our region here. It drains a lot of the water out of our area, but goes through, and a lot of it ends up in Te Waihora or Lake Ellesmere. So, you know, we're well aware of the challenges that the lake has, and these streams that flow into it are a crucial part of how we can mitigate some of those problems.
Mm-mm. And there's a lot of planting going on here right now.
Yeah, we've been very lucky. We started off essentially as an irrigation society looking at water issues, and as regulations evolved and the environment we operate in has evolved, we've changed to become Ellesmere Sustainable Agriculture. So that's worked very well. So we essentially, as a collective group, we're representing about 120 farmers and enable them to do things like this planting we see here today.
What other things does Ellesmere Sustainable Agriculture do for local farmers?
So we've been obviously helping them with regulations has been the big one. We're very lucky to have a planner within our committee or in our membership, and she's been an absolute amazing resource for us to submit on regulations and submit in a way that's not saying they're not needed, but more saying, you know, this approach may be more beneficial. Mm-hmm. So that's one area, but as we've gone along, we've had requests from our members, you know, can we help in a number of different ways? And that's where the extension project comes in, running courses and things for our members. So we also look at the effect on the well-being of our members as well. So as these regulations have come on, we have noticed a change in the well-being and the attitude and approach of farmers. They are getting a little bit downtrodden, so we are aiming to, you know, help give them some positive approaches and help that well-being issue, which we know is happening across all farming.
And you are treasurer for the society.
Yeah, it's really looking after the money, subs and so forth. But once we got the MPI projects, there's quite a considerable amount of accounting. So we have got some external help in to help us with some of that. So we're really lucky to get this money that the government gives us. So, you know, it's really important that as an organisation we can show that we're really good stewardships of that money and that we are putting it to very good use.
How much money have you received so far?
The initial funding for the Tinuku project was $1.8 million. And we got an additional $400,000 in year one as well. So in total, there's $2.2 million, and that's spread over 3 years.
My name is Jo Fern, and I am the Extension Project Coordinator. So the Tinuku project came out of Ellesmere Sustainable Agriculture. With that funding, we needed to create a new project. So it's the Tinuku project, but basically we're helping not only our own members, ESAI members, but others in the local community.
How many people have been employed so far through the Tinuku project?
I think it's averaged out at about 35 a month, which is really good. So that's not just, you know, we've got guys like Tom and Joseph here who are doing the restoration work, but it's also, you know, the workshops that we're running. So we're employing caterers to cater for those. We're employing people to facilitate those. We are also, with the Jobs for Nature, we've got staff working at local nurseries. It's been really widespread with the amount of work that we're providing.
Now, David, what are some of the biggest challenges farmers in this area have been facing over the past 20 years?
The numerous. I think because we have Lake Ellesmere or Te Waihora in our zone, we have been a little bit of a guinea pig from a regulations point of view. So a lot of the regulations have been applied to this zone first. But in a way, that's probably given us a bit of an insight into how to manage those regulations. And, you know, I guess to start with, a lot of them were around water and how irrigation consents were tied to water. But more recently, it's more around nutrient and nutrient loss and how we can manage that both on the farm but also in the environment, which we're trying to do here, obviously, with the riparian planting.
Mm. And there are a couple of permanent water sampling stations in the area. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we were wanting to understand, the background and the baselines of the water quality in our zone. So we've got identified two sites which are beside streams or drains, and we've put permanent measuring in there, which is telemetered, so we can gather that information every 15 odd minutes. And so that will hopefully give us what's happening as a baseline throughout the season, because there will be fluctuations during the season depending on flow and water quality and quantity. Because all these things we're doing to try to mitigate, such as the planting, we want to understand, you know, how much of an effect are they actually having in solving this problem. So because it's being done quite often, we should better see any changes, even if it's within a season.
Why do you think the water quality has, you know, declined so much? And how long do you think it will take to turn this around?
Oh, look, you know, to be honest, if you look at what's happened in Canterbury and the land use change, the intensification in agriculture, without a doubt, I think it's pretty naive to think that that hasn't had an impact on the receiving environment. So there's already multiple changes in management happening on farms, and you know that will take a long time to come through. Some areas will turn around quicker than others, and we are at the bottom end of the catchment, which essentially the drain plug of the system, and we do have quality and quantity coming onto us, which we have no control over. So I guess how we look at it is we say, well, let's control what we can within our own catchment, and that's exactly what we're doing here. But in saying that, we are now working with likes of CPW above us. We all realise that we need to understand what the whole catchment's doing, not just in our catchment down here at the Lowland Streams area.
And that's Central Plains Water?
Yeah, Central Plains Water. So they we're having conversations with them at the moment around a whole catchment project, so we can understand, you know, those exact questions. What is the big challenge across the catchment, and what are the areas that we need to really focus on?
Tell me about your farm, what you grow, and your family connection with the land.
So we're an arable farm. Well, in arable farms, we grow crops, and most of those crops are for seed. So we grow a wide range of crops from wheats and barleys, rye grasses and white clovers for seed, peas and beans for seed and for processing, as well as vegetable seeds, so radish. And a lot of those crops are export up to the Northern Hemisphere. And from a management point of view, I guess we've been probably 25 years understanding and knowing that our soil is a really important part, so we've been managing our soil well for those 25 years, which has allowed us to have a low input cropping system. And it's taken time, but we've got there, and we do have a lower input than the average, and as we're seeing at the moment with inflation and fertiliser prices, and that's a really good place to be in. In a way, it's about working with nature, and the planting is the same thing as well. You know, the planting is actually nature doing the work for us by filtering and allowing growth over the streams. So I just take that same approach into the paddock and in the farming system of, you know, making sure that we all the beneficial things that nature provides us, we can utilise the best we can.
My name's Johanna Blakely. I'm the Riparian Project Coordinator for the Tinaku Project. So for my role, I get to come on a lot of site visits, meet the farmers, the landowners who have potential project sites. They take us down to look at their generally waterways, wetlands, sometimes it's along drains, areas that they've identified that they think could really benefit from native restoration planting. So we look at the site, we assess it against some of our criteria, like how could this really benefit for biodiversity, water quality improvement, and then I draw up a plan. So looking at the soil types, the type of plants that would best suit the site, the types of plants that could best deal with the issues there, so if that's going to be filtering overland runoff, shading the waterway, stabilising the banks. Coming up with plant lists, ordering plants from the nurseries, getting the contractors on board, and then, yeah, we have planting contractors who come and do the actual planting and maintain the sites for 3 years.
And how many sites have you worked on so far?
So 40 planting sites, that's across about 25 to 30 different landowners. So some people have a couple of sites, they might have a couple of waterways or a waterway and a wetland, and just for the sake of location, we manage those separately.
Tell me about the site that we are at now. What are you planting, and how would you describe this location?
It's a small spring-fed waterway, and it's got
some existing remnants of native vegetation, which is relatively uncommon in this area. There's some mature Pittosporum tenofolium, cabbage trees, sedges. So basically what's happened, we've come and taken out a whole bunch of willows that were overhanging the creek. The farmers put in a new fence to protect the waterway, and we've come and planted with Carrick Sector right along the waterway edge, then a range of different native species further back along the bank. So there to shade and stabilise the waterway. A bit further downstream, there's a site where there's a big lot of overland runoff coming. So the farmer there has actually set the fence back quite far, and we've planted a whole lot of wetland species that should be able to filter and really reduce any sediment and pollutants coming in from that runoff. So, yeah.
What is the water quality like in this creek here?
The water quality in Jolly's Brook is actually relatively good. It's connected to, they call it the Little Rakaia Zone, so it's being flushed out by the Rakaia River. It's got really low nitrates. Probably the main issue in this waterway is more to do with sedimentation, which it's partly just naturally soft soils in this area. So we're really looking at habitat improvement, as well as just making sure that we maintain those low nitrate levels in the waterway where possible through plant absorption.
How many plants have you planted here at this site so far?
Yeah, so at this site we've got just over 2,000 plants in the ground. The farmer had already planted a couple of hundred off his own bat about 5 years ago. So, yeah, we try where possible to get eco-sourced plants, seed sourced from local native remnants in the area.
And you've got some people planting right now across the creek?
Yeah, so Tom and Joseph, they're here today doing some planting. They've been training up and gaining a lot of skills in native restoration work through as part of the Jobs for Nature aspect of the project.
What do you enjoy most about doing this this work?
I love getting out. I love meeting a range of people, being able to come alongside and support them. Often it's an area that they're really motivated to do something about. It's an area that I'm really passionate about, plants and water quality, water health. So I love being able to work with people and actually see changes on the ground. It's really, really positive space to be in.
So I'm Thomas Hilston. I'm currently working for Ellesmere Sustainable Agriculture as a planter. I do plant maintenance and wetland and riparian planting. So a lot of planting along drains around farms and in the catchment area around Lake Ellesmere.
How long have you been doing this for?
So I've been with Ellesmere Sustainable Ag for about a year now, and I got into it through a course I did with Department of Conservation, the Te Ara Atawhai course, that was held for 9 weeks.
What were you doing before you started this sort of work?
So I was dismantling vehicles for a firm, Nissan King Isuzu Parts World. So I was doing that for about 3 to 4 years.
Gosh, it's quite a different job.
Yes, it's very different.
And you've also started your own contracting business?
Yes, so I started my own contracting business through Ellesmere Sustainable Agriculture. So I run Kerikere Contracting, which does start to finish planting and maintenance, any type of weed spraying.
I'm Jo German-Benny. I've been on Ellesmere Sustainable Ag Committee since 2014. In that time I've been sort of in coordinating our communication. Since we've had our MPI project, Jobs for Nature project, I've been able to step back and our employees have been able to do that, but I've taken on coordinating an education project within our Tinaku project.
And what does that involve, that education project?
Back in 2019, our committee held a strategic planning day for our members. It was 10 years since we'd been incorporated society. We were all feeling fairly despondent that winter. Farming seemed to be a hard game, and we felt like we needed to do something positive for our members. So we decided to have an education project to engage the young people in our district with what we were doing. We recognised we were going to need some kaitiaki guardians of the planting that we were doing, and we hope that it will continue into the future, and obviously the young people in our district will be involved in that. We also wanted to promote primary industry careers, and we were thinking about succession planning in our committee. Most of us have got grey hair, or we're trying to hide grey hair. So we really want to encourage the young people into our industry and get them involved in our group.
Has that been quite a challenge, working out how to generate interest in agriculture locally?
We went and spoke to Ellesmere College when we got this project up and going, and we realised that if we could support the Gateways program, that was probably one very easy way of supporting young people into primary industries and other sectors. So we funded 6 Gateway students in our first year, 10 this last year. So a lot of them are coming on to our local farms. We've also been able to fund them to come on courses that ESAI runs for our members. For example, we've recently had a chainsaw course. We've had a chemical handlers course. We've got a forklift course coming up.
Very handy.
So those students have been able to come along to our courses and gain skills that are going to be highly valuable for when they go out into the workforce. We've also encouraged our ESAI members to take Gateway students, because it's quite hard to find businesses to take students.
Do you have a student on your farm?
I do, actually. We have a young lad called Logan who comes along once a week. He often has to stay after 3 o'clock, so after school hours. We've really enjoyed having him on our farm. It makes you think about what you're doing, because you have to explain to a young person what you're doing and why. That's been really good. It's been beneficial to us. We had him stay and look after the farm, and we went away for a couple of days on holiday, so that was an added bonus. And I think farming can be quite insular sometimes, so having someone come in and work with them, a young person, especially one that's maybe not your own child, is really positive, and it gives you good vibes.
What do you farm?
We're a mixed up farm, sheep and cropping farm. So barley, peas, white clover, ryegrass seed, and we have fine wool sheep.
How has Ellesmere Sustainable Agriculture impacted on your farming system? What have you gained from being a member?
Like many farmers in our district, we had to go through obtaining an irrigation consent. This is 10, 15 years ago. That was quite a stressful time for a lot of farmers. ESAI helped everyone through that. The same thing's happened since with farm environment plans. So we've run a lot of workshops so that farmers have been able to work through that themselves if they didn't want a consultant to do that, which I think is quite valuable. There's nothing like designing or developing and writing a plan yourself to actually know what's in it, rather than it being written by someone and stuck in the bottom drawer. And our farm's not actually down near the lake, but a lot of the farmers around the lake have dealt with cultural issues and requirements, and phosphorus sediment runoff requirements. So we've helped, ESAI has helped farmers work through all those different regulations.
What's the thing that you've done so far through ESAI that makes you most proud?
Our Tanaku project has been amazing and uplifting. It's something positive we've done for our district. It's the first time ESAI sought outside funding, because we've been funding this for 20 years on our own. So really exciting to get funding to carry that on and to expand it, and to have employees that we now have in our Tanaku project, our project manager, our riparian manager, our extension project manager, to have people paid to keep their eye on the ball and do that, because as volunteer committee members, there's only so many hours in a day. So we always had more we wanted to do, and we're a bit limited with time. So that's been very exciting.
Jo Benny ending Cosmo's story. Cosmo was also talking to David Burkett, another Ellesmere Sustainable Ag member, as well as Tinuku Project's Joanna Blakely, Tom Hilston and Joe Fern.
Now before we go, a note of thanks to all those behind the scenes of Country Life who helped us win Best Daily or Weekly Feature at the New Zealand Radio Awards this week. Our studio producer David Knowles and studio engineers William Saunders, Mark Chesterman and Phil Benge. And not least, thanks to all those who've allowed us to tell their stories over the past year, as well as our farming contacts around the country. That's it for now. Thanks for joining us. Ka kite.
Have a great weekend. Bye now.